This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, there are all kinds of reasons people will give you for the stock market's performance of late. Higher corporate profits is one. Solid market fundamentals is another. Even investors are just looking for a reason to buy. And that's certainly true. MasterCard reported first quarter profits today, a company whose earnings are directly tied to how much we spend. And we are spending a lot. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's May 2nd. It's a Wednesday, and it's good to have you here. MasterCard's having the kind of run you usually see only with oil companies, or with Google, maybe. MasterCard announced this morning quarterly profits jumped 70% over this time last year. We used our cards 16% more for a total balance due of $509 billion for just 3 months. But you might recall economists have been worried about a slide in consumer spending. So we asked Marketplace's Lisa Napoli to have a look around.
The government may see a spending slowdown, but MasterCard said on its earnings call this morning that it doesn't. For that, you can thank what the industry calls micropayments, meaning you aren't the only one using plastic to pay for that coffee or the fast food. Analyst Anurag Rana of KeyBank Capital Markets says the card industry is reaping the benefits of the push to go cashless for small purchases.
These guys have an initiative to penetrate the sub-$20 transaction market, that marketplace that was sort of insulated from, you know, card-based payments for some time.
And it's not all about racking up credit card debt either. David Robertson is publisher of the Nilson Report, which analyzes the card industry.
What is happening in the United States is the great use of the debit card. We are now a debit card country more than a credit card country.
Prepaid cards are another growing market for MasterCard. Robertson says another reason the company's raking in the dough is developing markets like Asia, Africa, and Latin America are increasingly embracing plastic money.
There's also a cachet in many developing markets. People want to use plastic payments to identify themselves with being part of the larger world economy.
Robertson says that in just a couple of years, plastic will overtake cash and checks as the currency of choice. In the meantime, MasterCard stock has tripled since the company went public just a year ago. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
If you think the average consumer's got debt problems, allow me to introduce you to the government of the United States of America. Uncle Sam's what you might call a chronic borrower. It pays for those loans with treasury bonds or notes. There's not much real difference between a note and a bond, by the way, just a length of maturity. Anyway, today we say goodbye to the 3-year treasury note. The government says the budget deficit's improved to the point that the feds no longer need it. But Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports investors shouldn't get too sentimental. The thing hasn't even been buried yet, and some market watchers are already talking about a resurrection.
Back in 2003, when the Treasury started offering the 3-year note, the U.S. budget deficit hovered around $400 billion. Fast forward to today, that deficit has been cut in half, so the feds don't need to borrow as much. And given the changes in interest rates, Mark Zandi with MoodysEconomy.com says the cost of a 3-year note versus a 30-year note boils down to a fraction of a percentage point.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to be issuing 3-year bonds when you can get the same interest rate on a 10-year or 30-year bond.
Historically speaking, it's relatively cheap for the government to borrow long-term money. David Weiss, chief economist with Standard & Poor's, says that gives the feds less incentive to borrow short-term.
Given that interest rates right now look low, it would make sense to continue borrowing as long a term as possible, lock in those low rates while we can.
But don't expect this to be a lasting trend. Economist Mark Zandi can already see ballooning deficits on the horizon.
If you look out a couple, 3-5 years down the road, all indications are that the deficit is going to be measurably larger and growing. The Treasury is going to need to issue a lot of bonds, and the 3-year will be back. So this is only a temporary goodbye. It's not the permanent one.
When the baby boomers start retiring, he says, the government will need to borrow heavily to pay for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And the 3-year Treasury note is expected to look attractive again. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Catching up on some news from yesterday, shares of Dow Jones Company held basically solid today as the board weighs Rupert Murdoch's $5 billion offer. Elsewhere, an enthusiastic day in New York. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Delta Airlines filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy September the 14th, 2005. 19 months and $3 billion in restructuring costs later, the new Delta begins life as a publicly traded company tomorrow morning. New shares are expected to start out somewhere around $20 apiece, which is around $20 more than the old Delta shares are worth now. We've asked our business correspondent Bob Moon to help us sort through the mechanics of a company getting out from under Chapter 11. And Bob, maybe the place to start is to note that the shares Delta took into bankruptcy were still trading up until just last week.
That's right. And, you know, Delta filed for reorganization back in September 2005, and the stock kept on trading on an over-the-counter location known as the Pink Sheets. Mm-hmm. And basically, you're really playing with fire if you continued to trade stock in that area. Delta had been warning its stockholders right out of the gate, no pun intended, from the time it filed for this bankruptcy protection, that the stock would be worthless under the reorganization plan. The wording was that current holders of Delta common stock would receive no distribution. That's a fancy way of saying that secured creditors come first in a bankruptcy filing like this, and the shareholders are way at the back of the line.
Defining our terms here, secured creditors are the big banks and people who have, you know, asset-backed stuff.
That's right. Owners of the planes, right, that sort of thing.
Now, when these new shares come out and start trading tomorrow, is Delta getting a huge influx of fresh cash?
No, they're basically divvying up the assets that they have among the creditors. The creditors will get shares. The workers will get shares. Executives will get shares. It's kind of interesting. If you look at the shares that the workers are going to receive, 14 million shares in the newly reorganized company, that amounts to about a 3.5% stake. The share that executives are getting is around half that size. But do the math here, and you figure out that that means Delta's stock and cash payments to the workers amounts to about maybe $12,000 each worker. The executive share here, their take is going to be about $200,000 each.
So once again, management gets and workers don't.
That's the way it appears.
Let me ask you about these individual shareholders, whether there's a way for them to know that they're going to get nothing. You and I know it because we follow these kinds of things. But if you've got a share of Delta and you see the price going down, is there a way for you to know that it's all going to end so badly?
Well, you know, people kept trading in Delta and some people apparently did make money. There were rumors that Delta might become an acquisition target. That caused the stock to bump up on those Pink Sheets. And so people were still making money. The problem is it's very risky, and the analysts warn you against doing that.
It's a risky game, too, because we're not talking about $40, $50 a share. It's stock that's at 18, 20 cents a piece. And so you buy a bunch of them, and it can end badly for you.
That's right. It was fluctuating between a dollar down into the pennies and then back up to $1.50, so you never know. But, you know, there are some investors who are just unsuspecting. They hear that a company is coming out of bankruptcy, for example, and they say, well, gee, the stock looks cheap. I'm going to go ahead and buy it. That's the old stock. It's confusing here. It's not the new stock that's being issued. The old stock just gets canceled out. And the SEC actually says that that's near the top of the list on the complaints that they receive every year. Mm-hmm. They actually even have a website to warn investors about this sort of thing. We have that on our website, marketplace.org.
DAL is the ticker symbol for Delta Airlines tomorrow morning on the New York Stock Exchange. Bob, thanks.
Thanks, Kay.
It's been true for a number of years now that a college degree just isn't enough anymore. New graduates need an internship or two under their belts as well, some paid, some not. That is, sometimes students pay for the chance to get work experience. So maybe it was inevitable that entrepreneurs would see an opportunity there. Pat Loeb has more.
Lauren Liebes graduated from Boston University with three internships under her belt. Gone, she says, are the days of summer jobs that help pay tuition. Now, working for free at an internship is vital to making a college degree count.
You have to. I think it's hard to graduate and get a job with nothing, just scooping ice cream over the summer.
That's why Liebes was willing to explore any angle to get an internship in the music industry, even seeking out a service that charges thousands of dollars to help. For Liebes, it paid off.
It totally changed my life. The music industry is so hard, so you really just need to get your foot in the door.
Liebes got an unpaid internship with a music production company, which turned into a part-time job during her senior year and then helped her get her first job after graduation. She believes she never would have gotten into the industry without the help of the University of Dreams. That's one of a growing number of private for-profit businesses created to respond to the new reality in higher education, that academic work is only part of what a student needs. The University of Dreams is one of the largest programs, with 850 students a summer taking part, and it's certainly one of the most expensive. Fees range from $6,500 for an 8-week internship in Chicago or San Francisco to $9,000 for one in London. Eric Lochtefeld founded the company 7 years ago when the dot-com boom had high-tech companies beating the bushes for interns. He planned to charge employers for finding them interns, but then the boom went bust. He decided to test the waters to see if students or their parents would pay. They did.
And really, it's all just come down to outstanding service. I mean, if you charge a premium like we do, you know, you really have to deliver on that service.
Lochtefeld says the company delivers coveted internships because it has an ongoing relationship with sought-after employers like BMG Music. BMG's human resources manager, Cheryl Allison.
They do a lot of that initial grunt work for me. And so there's a level of professionalism that I haven't gotten sometimes in just even unsolicited resumes from college students.
Allison says she gets all her summer interns from the University of Dreams now, but she also takes on interns the rest of the year through local schools. The particular genius of Lochtefeld's business plan is that the internship itself is only part of the equation. The fees include room and board, daily transportation, workman's comp insurance, weekend excursions, and weekly seminars. That is something parents are more likely to pay for. Take Lauren Liebes. Her parents were willing to pay her summer room and board anyway. And the extras?
Kind of reminded me of summer camp a little bit, like sleepaway camp.
For parents who paid for summer camps all their kids' lives, along with music lessons, sports clinics, and tutors, and who are shelling out tens of thousands of dollars for a college education, this is just one more expense to give their kids that extra advantage. Still, it rankles college counselors who place students in internships at no charge all the time. Dario Bravo manages the internship program at UCLA.
It does bother me that people would try to exploit students with charging them, you know, because students don't have to do that.
Bravo figures he's placed several thousand students in internships absolutely free. Still, he knows that inside information on internships can be lucrative. He got a $40,000 advance for his book, The Internship Advantage. Of course, that book is available to anyone for under $15. In Los Angeles, I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
Of the last 24 trading days on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has finished higher than where it started 21 times. Today's close of 13,211 was yet another record high. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 are on quite a run themselves. But commentator Robert Reich would like to point out that raw stock market numbers really have very little to do with the economy that most of us live in.
I'm spending my spare time these days debating supply-siders who are convinced that the record-breaking Dow proves the correctness of the Bush tax cuts. Yes, the Dow did reach a record high last week, but the Commerce Department also reported that economic growth slowed to its weakest pace in 4 years. Now, how can investors do so well while the real economy is doing so poorly? My supply-side friends don't have an answer, but I do. It's because of two great decouplings that have occurred in recent years. First, the rest of the world's major economies have decoupled from the United States economy. China, India, Japan, and Europe are now such large markets they can grow briskly even as America slows. Second, America's largest corporations have decoupled from the United States. Their overseas subsidiaries are booming, even as their American operations languish. General Electric expects more than half its revenue this year to come from outside the U.S. for the first time. More than half of Boeing's new orders are from overseas. Ford is struggling in America but doing well in Europe. The president's supply-side tax cuts are great for America's global investors, who have been investing their extra money around the world, either in foreign companies or in global American-based ones. But little or nothing is trickling down to average working Americans. Half of U.S. households do own some shares of stock, usually through IRAs or 401ks, but the vast majority own less than $5,000 worth. Their equity is in their homes, whose values have slumped. They're paying far more for health insurance and fuel, and their wages have not kept up. In other words, the Bush tax cuts have delivered for Wall Street, but they have done zilch for America's main streets.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He was Secretary of Labor during the first Clinton administration. Keep those cards and letters coming, folks, or, you know, emails anyway. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, American Idol, China style.
It will contain no harsh criticism, weepy fans, vulgar songs, or other unspecified weirdness.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 75 points, 0.5% to finish at 13,211. The NASDAQ jumped 26 points, 1% to end at 2557. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, 0.2% to close at 1495. The Dolan family's offer to take Cablevision private rocketed the cable TV company and owner of Madison Square Garden up nearly 10% today. Whirlpool swished up 4.2% on government data showing a bigger rise than expected in factory and durable goods orders. Lawnmower maker Toro followed with a rise of nearly 2%. Time Warner ticked up 1.7% today. The media giant posted an 18% drop in first quarter profits, but still somehow beat Wall Street's expectations. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases first quarter productivity figures. The House Select Energy Independence and Global Warming Committee hears from insurance experts on how global warming will affect their business. And got a good ghost story? Share your unique supernatural experiences on Paranormal Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Hey, who's there? Is someone in the studio with me? I can't see you, but I know you're there. Hello?
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The National Basketball Association playoffs continue this evening. Denver's at San Antonio. The Lakers go to Phoenix. And chances are that at any point in either one of those games, the majority of the players will be black and the referees will be white. The New York Times reports today that simple fact could determine the final score. A new academic study in the works has found that when a player's black and the ref is white, that ref is more likely to call a foul. There's a similar racial bias the other way, too, when a ref's black and the player's white, although the contrast is not quite as stark. Alan Schwartz wrote the story.
What we tried to make the point of was to say that this is something that happens in many areas of society. It happens in the determination of whether people are going to be given a home loan by a bank. It happens whether a taxi driver will stop for a certain type of race of patron at midnight in the inner city. We know that this takes place in other areas of society. It has been found to exist as well on the basketball court of the National Basketball Association. The experts that we consulted told us almost invariably that they would have been surprised if it didn't exist.
The thing that struck me when I was reading it, and I thought about your home loan example and business meetings by a black executive or an Asian American woman. This is in the crucible of an NBA game. It's a snap indicator of bias.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way that sociologists and econometricists and the meetings of those two have come to determine this is through tests and other ways of measuring how people collectively make decisions in sort of high-profile, discernible, and snap-second judgment type of environments. What they have found is that otherwise liberal and well-meaning and fair people do tend in the aggregate to show and own race bias. Whites favor whites and blacks favor blacks. It is not that striking, okay, because it's so subtle that you would never really know if that was the issue if you were going through it yourself. But if you pan far back enough and get enough data and control for enough things, which is what the economists know how to do, you are able to identify better and isolate what the reasons for this collective behavior may be, so that the individual people involved might consider it.
Before I let you go, Alan, what about the men arguably most affected by this, at least in this instance? You know, if you narrow it down from the broader workplaces we were talking about to these 10 guys running around on the court, what do they have to say?
Well, players, it is such a hot-button topic, of course, that players not only are a little reluctant to discuss it publicly, but also they hadn't seen the paper. A few of them, however, were kind enough to share their immediate thoughts, and they really dismissed the possibility of this taking place because they do see the NBA courts as being a place which is very fair. Now, we have to take that at face value, but we also, I think, need to remember that this type of bias, is the whole point behind it, is it is not detectable by the person who experiences it, or certainly not detectable in any accurate manner. It is a phenomenon that can only be diagnosed through a very large amount of interactions and data, and no individual player could possibly amass that type of experience.
Alan Schwartz at the New York Times with a story this morning on racial bias in foul calls in the National Basketball Association. Alan, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've got a link to the Times report on our homepage, marketplace.org. It's a big night on American Idol tonight. Two of the six finalists will be going home, pretty much guaranteeing another Nielsen-shattering audience for that broadcast. But let me ask you this. Would it be half as much fun to watch if the FCC tried to impose its standards of good taste? Well, welcome to Happy Boys. It's China's second try at a national talent show. Last year's Supergirls was a little wild, I guess. And sponsors are hoping the sequel will be just as profitable. Donna Renee reports now from Beijing.
China's censors felt last season's Supergirls went over the top. The finale alone drew 400 million viewers, nearly a third of the country's entire population. Supergirls had all the hallmarks of the Fox TV version: sarcastic, egotistical judges, vicious gossip, big hair, and about as much talent as a grade school choir. And just like American Idol, people either loved it or hated it.
I don't like the show, but I understand their dreams. They are the dream of being a star, and they work hard for that.
I think it's stupid. Sorry to say, because, you know, they sound so bad. They wear strange clothes, and they look terrible.
Capturing last season's title was a husky-voiced 21-year-old named Li Yuchun. 3.5 million fans from all over China voted for her via text message. But the real winner was Hunan Satellite TV, which raked in more than 100 million yuan, roughly $12.5 million. And yogurt sales for the program's sponsor, the Meng Yu Milk Group, reportedly jumped 270%. Not so thrilled? Government censors. As a result, Happy Boys, the new male version of the contest, will contain no harsh criticism, weepy fans, vulgar songs, or other unspecified weirdness. Chinese leaders hope Happy Boys will become the model reality show for a more virtuous, free market China. Some Peking University students say it just may work.
Maybe the censorship will make it more popular because the censorship will draw more attention from the public.
I think the point is making money and make it safe. Yeah, it may lose some audience, but it still can make money.
Peking University Communications Professor Wu Jing says officials felt obliged to get involved in the franchise after complaints from parents and educators.
I don't think there's real conflict here, but the government needs some cultural authority, needs to do something to show that they are not just the head of commercial television. They are building a good, harmonious society.
But Wu doubts bureaucrats at the State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television, the Chinese version of the FCC, have the power or the desire to really get in the way of such a huge moneymaker.
Their only power in theory is to shut down the television station, and I don't think they would do that. They might be secretly happy about what the stations have turned out and contributed to the profit. So they are just paper tigers, I think.
Professor Wu predicts if Happy Boys raises any eyebrows at all, it'll be because they look like a bunch of girly men.
For the boys' show, I would guess that the controversy would be that most of the boys are too womenized, feminine, rather than masculine.
20-year-old fan Angie Liu doesn't care. Just bring on the boys.
It's feminist. We have boys showing themselves to women. Not always girls showing themselves to men. I like to enjoy eye candy men, not eye candy girls.
In Beijing, I'm Donna Renee for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, as the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, Stuart Bowen probably hasn't made a lot of friends in the Bush administration. His office has uncovered billions of dollars worth of waste, fraud, and corruption in Iraq. But now the tables might have turned. A special White House office on integrity says it's investigating Bowen for possible ethical complaints. We called. Neither the White House nor Bowen's office were available for comment by airtime, but one source told Reuters that Bowen failed to come into work for long periods of time and that he used his office's resources to work on a book about the Reconstruction. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 75 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 26 points, that is 1%. The S&P 500 rose 9 points, 0.2% there. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, and Joel Stein. Next time on the program, getting taken to the cleaners.
Wet cleaning, there's more labor involved. That's why it costs a little bit more. But, you know, some people are willing to pay for that because they, you know, they want to be environmental friendly.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
Thank you.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.